Welcome to the Adventure Options Podcast. You want adventures and you have options. This episode, I interviewed Dan Moore, who is kind of hard to nail down into one job. He has run the gamut from business owner to educator to consultant, and he's even a band member. Stick around to find out what detritus is and to hear us chatter on about the ATTA. As always, this podcast is sponsored by Adventure Writers. There are 4.6 billion web pages out there. How will yours stand out? Visit adventurewriters.agency for help. That's adventure, W-R-I-T-E-R-S, .agency. Now for the show.
Dan, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
How are you doing today?
It's a good day.
I am having a hard time thinking of how to introduce you on this podcast, and that is because you have a million jobs. When I was looking both at your LinkedIn profile and your consulting website and your profile on the ATTA, which is the, adventure.
Trade association. Yeah,
that's right. And then you have a band, and then you teach at a school. Where do you start when someone says, "Hey, Dan, what do you do?" Where do you even start?
Yeah, I mean, you correctly identified what I'm older than a millennial, but I think that I take after a lot of those traits that are commonly attributed to the millennial realm, which is why settle to do one thing when you can assemble this collage of things that you're passionate about and excited about. So me personally, I'm working to uplift the standards and the sustainability of the travel industry. I do that as a travel guide. I do that as a consultant, as a trainer, and I do that as a traveler as well, because I think a big part of uplifting that is being a good traveler and meeting those goals. But then I also am fortunate to play music in a band and all the other fun stuff that you listed off.
Well, and my heart wants to talk about the band. However, it has nothing to do with adventure travel. And the reason I did want to bring you on was your work with, I think you call it ecotourism, or at least one of the sites that was listing off your accomplishments called it ecotourism. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to hear how you got into that, what your role in that is, if it's the same as sustainable travel, or if it's different in your opinion. Why is it the same? Why is it different? Why don't you start there?
Yeah, I think that, so first of all, yeah, you asked some good questions that I think there are some misconceptions about what ecotourism is. And so me personally, my background is in natural history. I studied education, and I used to work at a nature park here in Seattle. And I worked professionally for about 10 years as an outdoor educator. Okay. And you know, that really sets the stage for what I've tried to do in the travel industry. And once I entered the travel industry, I started working for an adventure travel company based here in Seattle, but they operate throughout the West Coast. It's called Evergreen Escapes. And I still guide for them from time to time.
Yeah, I did look at their website. I think they have some tours or packages down here in the Portland area as well.
Yeah, there's a whole office in Portland and at one point in California too. So, you know, all along the West Coast, even up into British Columbia. And so what I brought to that table was the nature and environmental aspect. And so we often interchange words like ecotourism, adventure tourism, experiential tourism, sustainable tourism. Mm-hmm, and, yeah. And to the consumer, most of the time, that doesn't mean anything at all. They just want to go on a trip that's meaningful, that's exciting.
But it does make them feel good about it, because it feels like, I mean, those are catchphrases that feel like, oh, they're not just ruining the planet.
Right. And I think a big part of that is, what do they attribute to those different categories? So there's a whole subgenre of the travel industry called ecotourism. And when you dig into the literature about how those people who draw that circle around their profession define ecotourism, it has a little bit to do with doing what's right for the planet and to communities. There's an ethos involved in that. But then there's also the aspect of nature-based tourism, which ecotourism, so just doing sustainable food tourism in downtown Portland, Oregon, is not ecotourism. It doesn't involve interaction with the environment. Uh-huh. And so that's where the word eco has kind of, I don't want to use the word hijack, because I think it's perfectly acceptable to think eco is both due to outdoors and the environment and nature, but also has to do with sustainability. And so there's ecologically sensitive tourism, there's ecotourism, which would be two different things.
What's the difference between those two, ecological tourism and ecotourism?
Right. Well, I don't think anyone would, I guess what I'm saying is there's a difference between the word being ecologically sound or or sensitive to the environment or sustainable, than an ecotourism is more defined more specifically as being sustainable tourism, but also in nature. So like a bird tour in Forest Park in Portland, or a 10-day trip in the Amazon rainforest where you're studying scarlet macaws. Like, those are all ecotourism experiences that, in theory, if they're truly ecotourism, would not only have the nature aspect, but would be ecologically sound and sensitive and sustainable. So I think people often conflate that all tourism that is environmentally sound and sustainable is therefore ecotourism. And again, it's whatever you want to say as the traveler, but those who are the academics studying and teaching about ecotourism would say it requires that interaction with the environment and nature aspect.
Because I've even heard people define it as including that the money stays in the country where you are as part of that whole sustainable tourism. So is that part of it, or is that being mislabeled as well?
Well, and again, with any of these titles, who gets to decide what it is and isn't, right?
Me. So I get to decide.
And that's exactly why what I figured by being on this podcast, that therefore now I can learn what the true definition is. Yeah. But the reality is that part of ecotourism does have both the benefit to the environment as well as benefit to the local communities. And as you dive into the actual definitions from groups like the International Ecotourism Society or GSTC, or you know, any of these other groups that are focusing on sustainability, then you start to understand that yes, the nature-based tourism is important. The benefit for local people is important. How much money stays in the community? Those are all principles of ecotourism. Absolutely.
Okay, and so as a consumer, mm-hmm. how would I be able to tell if someone's just throwing that on their website? Is there some kind of standard? Is there, you know what I mean? Is there some kind of, you know, board approval to become an ecotourism friendly tourist group? Or how do I know that as a consumer?
Right. So I think you're kind of scratching a wound, I should say. I don't even want to say it like that, but you're like opening up.
I'm pouring salt on a wound.
You're opening up something that's extremely important for the travel industry overall, that has not just to do with sustainability, but also just to do with quality and
standards.
You look on the internet, and this is actually an activity in the ecotourism class that I teach, where I give them basically a few keywords and they punch it into their favorite search engine. I don't like to, give
you're not going to say they Google it.
I'm not going to give uncompensated plugs for any specific search engine, but I think you could probably assume which one they're going to choose.
Right.
Bing, of course. And
depending on their smartphone, which one automatically pulls
up. That's true. Anyway, so they punch that in. And even though the search engine people, the Googles of the world, are going to curate what you see based upon what you've searched for in the past, and it's not a guarantee that it's going to end up like this, but for the most part, using the keywords that I use, a small group, Olympic Peninsula tour, natural park, whatever, it comes up with a list of about 10 different options. Six of them are the exact same trip, but sold by different entities. Exactly. One of those 10 is the actual company, which is my former company, Evergreen Escapes. But the rest of them are Viator, are
TripAdvisor, whatever. I don't know who you guys work through, but yeah.
I can't even remember all the different resellers, but it's a bunch of you know, six of the 10 are the exact same trip. So similarly, you want sustainable tour and whatever, eco tour. It's very difficult to trust whatever you're going to get on the internet. And that's just the reality of the day. So for those people who are sustainably minded, there are different ways. There are some certifications, like I alluded to GSTC, which is Global Sustainable Tourism Council. But what I recommend is actually finding a travel professional, whether it's a travel agent, a tour operator, or whatever, that you can get to know. And then you understand, you trust them, and you understand what types of experiences they specialize in. And they get to know that you're focused on sustainability or on whatever. And then they do the vetting for you. That's what I think is it's interesting, because at one point everyone thought travel professionals invited, you can do everything on the internet. And the reality is it's going backwards. It's going the other direction, because there's just so much detritus, is what I use my ecological biology term on.
I have no idea what that word means.
Detritus is, so imagine you're in the forest and you see a whole
Not hard to do here.
Exactly.
Well, look out my window.
Look down upon the ground and you see sticks and decomposing leaves and pebbles and rocks and other things like that. All that is the group called detritus, just a bunch of unidentifiable clutter on the forest floor.
Wow. I did not think I was going to get that lesson today. You truly learn something new every single day.
So anyway, that to me, that's the idea, is to find somebody you trust that you acknowledge is in it for the right reason. And there's plenty of people who are focusing on ecotourism, sustainable tourism, adventure tourism. And you know, most of the people that I work with in the industry on the supply side, almost all of them want to / think they are doing the right thing. The issue is having the mechanism to study and analyze whether indeed is the majority of the money going back into the community.
Yeah.
Are these services sustainable? You know, we make assumptions like, oh, giant tour bus must be terrible for world. Well, in some respects, that could be. But also, if you're on some private tour in a Land Rover, are you using
more gas than
more fuel than the mass tour? Yes. So we have to start actually comparing apples to apples in these settings, and be willing to say, maybe my type of travel isn't actually very good, even though it has this nice green border around it.
Yeah, even though they have on their website, we are eco-friendly.
Exactly, right. And my favorite is, we use local food when available. Well, you know, who defines available? It's like, we chose to have asparagus on the market in the middle of September. It's like, well, that's, and sorry, it's not available locally. Well, that's your own fault for choosing the wrong type of food. So that, I think that we need to start holding people companies, ourselves accountable. To actually, if we believe in sustainability, we actually have to go to that, push to go to that next level.
So what brought you down this road? Like, what made you passionate about it? What made you want to teach about it? What was your journey into it? Should I just pepper you with lots of questions?
Was it
different 15 years ago? Because didn't you get into the travel industry 15 years ago?
Yeah, about that. So my background, as I said, is in education, and I was living in Bolivia in 1996, 97, right after I graduated from college.
I actually saw that. You lived in Bolivia, Peru, and Brazil, I want to say?
I've traveled to on that trip, I traveled those places, but my base camp was in La Paz, Bolivia. Amazing part of the world. This past fall, got to go back for the first time in more than 20 years. And it's amazing just that civilization exists at that elevation.
I lived in Ecuador.
Oh yeah.
On the border of Peru.
Oh, right.
For 6 months, working in an orphanage there, in the middle of college. Actually, I took a college sabbatical, if you will.
That's important.
Were you at elevation? In fact, I had brought I mean, this is frivolous, but I had brought in all of my shorts and t-shirts, and I had to buy a whole bunch of wool clothes. It was freezing in Ecuador. You wouldn't even think, but we were up in the mountains in a mountain city, and it was a really cool thing.
Well, the good news though is that some of the best quality wool products are produced in the Andes from alpaca.
So cheap.
Mm-hmm.
It was so inexpensive. I shouldn't say cheap. It was not cheaply made. It was inexpensive to buy.
Right, exactly. It was a good value for the high quality value that you're getting. Yeah, absolutely. And you know, and if you're choosing the right people to buy from, all of a sudden your travel experience there was leaving money into that community.
I don't think I had a choice. I'm pretty the town was Cuenca, Ecuador.
Oh yeah, I've heard of it.
Okay. It's not really a travel destination. You don't really have a choice but to buy locally and eat locally. It's beautiful. But yeah.
Well, anyway, so I was living in Bolivia, had just graduated from college shortly before that, and I kind of had two different tracks that I had left college thinking I was interested in. One was environmental advocacy. I've been interested in environmental advocacy since I was in elementary school. Went to an environmental learning center and basically just learned how important the environment is for our survival. It seems like duh, everybody should know that, but right. it was an important lesson for me at that age. And then the other track was ecology. I had studied ecology in school, in college, and was interested in perhaps doing some kind of research, botany, wildlife, whatever. So I went to Bolivia and was experimenting with both of those things. The environmental advocacy was kind of a bust because people saw that I was American, assumed that I was going to help them do all these things, and I didn't have the experience or the knowledge or anything to really
the resources,
help them, any of that. And so I didn't end up learning in the way that I thought I would. I learned about that some of that imbalance that is faced in the world and this perception that, and I deal with that to this day as a consultant, this perception that just because we're from the U.S., we must know something, everything must be great here. And I think that's really useful to send that message that no, actually you're very knowledgeable and I'm coming here to learn from you.
Right.
So then I also did some research in botany in the tropical lowlands of Bolivia, which was absolutely fantastic. But what really changed my world was meeting a teacher there who was just talking about her students and how every day all these lessons that each of them were learning, including herself. And I realized that if I'm going to change the world, it's through education. So I went home and I studied environmental education. I got a graduate certificate in that. Then I moved to Seattle in 1999 and started working professionally in that realm. So anyway, so I come to Seattle and I work professionally in environmental education and working in nature parks and working directly with young people, but then also training adults to be those educators and those stewards.
You do that at what college?
Well, this was even before all that.
Oh, this is before that? Okay.
Yeah, this is before I even got into the travel industry. And a guy walked into the park I was working in, wanted to be one of those volunteers. And I was asked the question, why? Yeah. Why is an important question to ask to make sure that we were aligned. And he said, well, I'm starting this adventure tour company and I need to learn how to educate people on the environment and on nature and all that.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, exactly. And so it turned out that for him to get to the caliber he wanted to be at was an amount of time that he didn't have to commit, but it got me in the door of working with him. And that was how we started Evergreen Escapes.
What was the name of this person?
That's Jake Hoppert, who's the founder of Evergreen Escapes. And now he's running a new company. What is it? Explorer X is his new business. Yeah. So
a plug for Jake.
I know. I didn't. God darn. You better.
you better send him an invite.
Buy me a beer for real. Do it all the time. So anyway, so that's in starting this company and we had this really interesting timing because we started, he officially launched in late 2006, and then I came on board in 2007,
And then the market crashes.
What happens in 2008 is like everything falls apart. And thankfully, we were just on the cusp of kind of diving in headfirst with some investment. And thankfully, we didn't do that yet. So we were able to be very smart about how we grew. And but it was really tragic. It was really humbling because all around us were these people with way more experience than us, way more great ideas and all these other things that were literally falling around us. Businesses going out all the time. So how did we benefit from that? We benefited because we were a positive story in a time period of just terrible stories all left and right. So we got a lot of good media attention about it. We got a lot of people that normally would have never been able to work for us or with us because we didn't have enough money to pay for that caliber. But they were industry veterans were out of work and came on board and worked with us. I say with us versus for us because it was really a team effort in that respect. And a lot of people were rooting for us. So we got a lot of guidance from the local destination marketing groups. The other businesses were excited to help us out. So in the process of that, I learned a tremendous amount about the industry, about business, about all these things, and basically a crash course for 6 years.
Were you a member of the ATTA at that point?
Yeah. So one many great ideas that Jake had was to get engaged in all these organizations, and again, that's how we got that support and help from our community. So ATTA was right away one of our early memberships, and I started going to their Adventure Travel World Summit starting in 2008 when it was in Norway, and I've been every year since.
I saw that. That's quite the accomplishment. that's a lot of World Summit. Is it Tuscany this year?
Yeah, it's in Italy this year.
Are you going?
Yes. Because I'm one of those people, and they'll probably raise the rate just for Dan next year. It's like, hey, he's going to go. So that's
he's going to pay it.
Because I'm one of the, there's a local music festival here in Seattle called Bumbershoot, and it's every Labor Day. And I went every year religiously from when I moved to Seattle. And then a couple of years
ago. To play or to... Listen,
I got to play 1 year, which was actually I played twice officially, but once was on a major stage, and it was one of the highlights of my music career. And I, in general, loved Bumbershoot, but as time has gone on, both I've aged, so I'm not as into a lot of the music anymore. Combined with it's now run by, even though it's a local organization that still controls a lot of it, it's run by an international company. It's just not marketed towards me, and it's really expensive. And so finally, last year, I was just like, I'm not going to Bumbershoot. And it was painful because I get into these habits. So yeah, the Adventure Travel World Summit is very important to me. I see some of my best friends who live all around the world. They show up every year to this conference.
Oh, it's like a little class reunion.
It is. And again, how do I... what I do for a living is I market myself as somebody who in theory knows something, but the reality is I know things because I interact with very smart people who share information with me, not like confidential or like I'm exposing trade secrets or anything, but they're sharing with me what's going on in the industry, their perception of it, the trends, and then I bring it to another place in the world. I learn from them, and it's really a community building endeavor is what I end up doing for a living, which is pretty fun.
Or you invite them on your podcast and have them spill all their secrets.
Yes,
and then you take over their job.
Well, I don't take over anybody's job, but
I'm saying I'm going to do that.
Okay.
I'm the next tourism consultant. Give me 15 years of interviewing podcast people and.
There's a lot to be said about that. On my podcast, Trails to the Border, there's my plug.
Yeah, there you go.
We had to, just right before this conversation, we had Mike Bursick, founder of Sacred Rides Mountain Bike Tours, on our podcast. And here, we just asked one question, and like literally the textbook started being written, right? And if we had closed captioning, it would have been like the textbook for how to do adventure tourism. It was pretty incredible. But people in our industry are excited for I mean, we're not doing this to be the only ones in the market. We're doing this because we believe that this type of travel is better for the traveler. If done right, again, we have to really hold ourselves accountable when done right. It can be better for local people, and it can mean economic benefit and social benefits for communities that are struggling with resource extraction and their kids not being able to stay in their communities anymore because of lack of opportunity. So we really have an opportunity when done right. Tourism can be a positive thing.
And you hit on a good note, is that the majority of the people in this industry are very open and willing. In fact, I've been really shocked who has responded to my messages and said, sure, I'll come on your podcast. They don't even know who I am. They've never heard my name. I don't have any big clout. I'm probably not going to help their careers for quite some time, but they just want to share their knowledge and their experience and hopefully inspire other people to continue doing, you know, all those things we talked about, the ecotourism and the sustainable tourism and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's cool. Yeah, that's awesome. So of all of the world summits that you've been to, which one has been your favorite?
Well, so, I mean, one of the challenges, and I know this from communicating with the people that put on this conference, which is the Adventure Travel Trade Association, the challenge is how do you make the content relevant to both the people at more towards the beginning of their career, or their beginning in adventure tourism, or they're just beginning of learning about this information.
Or their still, product, isn't there product people in there as well?
Exactly.
Not just tourism.
Right, exactly. And yet still relevant to those who have been around for a long time and have shown up. And so certainly I'm more on that latter category now. So what I enjoy are learning the new trends, but also the inspiration pieces, hearing from entrepreneurs or environmental activists like Doug Tompkins was, the late Doug Tompkins, who is the founder of North Face and Esprit. But more importantly, in my opinion, he and his wife have bought large swaths of land in Patagonia, Chile, and Argentina, and have preserved it and are turning them into national parks. And so that was a speech that was given at the Adventure Travel Summit in Chile in 2015. I'd say definitely the earlier summits for me were, the second one I went to was in Quebec in Canada. And that was, the content was just mind-blowing, because here I am very young in the career, not knowing much about anything, having a little bit of experience now under my belt, but not that much. And so I felt like from a content perspective, that was still to this day one of the best summits that I've been to. But then, in 2016, the summit was brought back to the United States. It started here in Seattle for the first 2 years, and then it hadn't been back in the United States since until 2016 in Alaska. And it was very exciting as an American to have been all these amazing destinations around the globe, but here it was back in my country, and Alaska did a fantastic job of hosting it. And it was actually Visit Anchorage, a city in a very non-populated city on the scale of cities,
right,
hosting the world stage of adventure tourism. And they really stepped up to the plate. And I loved that summit as one of my favorites for many reasons. This year will be interesting in Tuscany, because I think similar to the United States, a lot of people have this perception of adventure is somewhere else. It's in the tropic, it's in the global south, it's quote unquote exotic, whatever, and not recognizing that actually adventure tourism is an important part of tourism in even developed countries like Italy and like the United States. And in fact, there's a lot going on in those. So I'm excited to see how they presented, especially to not just quote unquote developed country like Italy, but a country that's reputation for tourism has very little to do with adventure, with the exception of maybe bicycling tourism. But for the most part, people think about Italy, they think about food tourism, they think about culture, history. But I was just there.
Wine.
Yeah, exactly. All things that pair, to use a nice culinary word, pair nicely with adventure activities. In fact, I was there in April doing some training for Ciclismo Classico, a fantastic bicycle tour company, and training their guides. And here are some people 20, 30 years in the industry, and they're still like at the edge of their seats, like participating and wanting to learn more, really demonstrating that guides are artists and always growing and learning. But I ask a lot of questions when I do any training. You know, what does an experience on one of your trips look like? And they start giving me, you know, telling the story about what the experience is about. And it's, yeah, bicycling is an important part of it. That's the adventure activity, but yeah, it's the connecting with local people. It's the visiting the olive oil farm. It's the eating local food, trying to learn the language. All these things are so integral to what adventure tourism really is about that it's almost unfortunate that we use the word adventure, because I think it just sometimes it
sounds physical.
Exactly. But so anyway, I'm excited to go to this summit in Italy and see what you know, just really how this story continues to evolve.
Have you presented at any of these summits?
Yeah, so fortunately, I've had the opportunity to present, similar to like we were talking about the music festival Bumbershoot, like going to that festival, and then finally one day getting the honor to take a big stage and having a ton of people out there that it would have never seen my band. Similar idea was being able to present at some of the world summits, because again, it's an honor to be on a stage in front of your peers. It's also
right,
a little bit nerve-wracking, honestly, because here are people that you've learned from, and then you're presenting information to them. But yeah, I presented at 2014, 2015, and 2016.
What did you present on?
Well, one of the things that I've been focusing on in our industry is the standards for adventure travel guides, as well as training of those guides. And so I helped organize a group of people who created the Adventure Travel Guide Standard. And so in 2014, leading up to the making of that standard, I presented on just guide standards and training in general. 2015, we had created the standard. So by then I presented the standard. And then 2016, we had been out in the field testing it through a guide training program that I put together for ATTA.
And there weren't standards in the field before then?
Yeah, so this is a really important question, because there are various certifications and standards for sub aspects of the group. Like there's, of course, International Federation of Mountain Guides in Europe. There's American Mountain Guides Association here in the U.S. You've got the British Canoe Union, the American Canoe Association. You've got Wilderness Medical Society. So you have all these sub certifications. And yeah, but there was nothing that really covered the entire umbrella of what it, I mean, I alluded to this before, adventure tourism is a lot more than knowing how to make sure that your anchors are set properly when you do rock climbing.
Yeah.
There's customer service, there's content delivery, so your interpretation of the nature or the cultures that you're visiting. And then, of course, we wouldn't have an industry if we didn't have sustainability. So
yeah.
What we did at putting together the standard was identified five core competencies that all adventure travel guides should possess of some form. And it's all going to be relative to where you're guiding, what activities you're doing, who your audience is. But those general categories of competencies are required to some extent. And then there's some universal things like navigation and safety and risk management and just general customer service, and that regardless of where you're at or what you're doing, you should possess those.
You should have those. That's awesome. And you do this through your consulting firm, right?
Yeah. So initially I was hired by the Adventure. So the organizer of this, the Adventure Travel Trade Association, is basically at the epicenter of what's going on in adventure tourism. Not everybody is tied into them, and they don't know about everybody in the world, but they're the only international organization that's kind of holding it all together.
I think they have upwards of what, 1,400 members at this point? Something like that.
Exactly. And again, relative to the amount of adventure tourism industry or businesses and travelers. I mean, that's just a fraction. But
that's companies too. That's not even the people. So I mean, you're looking at things like North Face as one of those 14,
exactly, right,
not the, you know, all the people that work for them. But
that's exactly it. But also, more importantly, being the only entity that's really wrapping this whole industry up internationally, they're the lightning rod for when the media wants to learn about adventure tourism, or right, when the UN World Tourism Organization wants to conduct a study. So they recognize that responsibility. Their members were saying for years, we need to do something about guide training, guide standards. So they were one of my first clients when I started my consulting company in 2014, and hired me to do an analysis of what is going on globally for standards, for training. It was really eye-opening. I mean, it was a huge job, and one that I had to just be comfortable with, not turning over every stone, because there were so many stones that had little...
You'd still be out there, yeah.
Exactly. But the gist of it was, there was no unifying standard for all of the requirements for an adventure travel guide. When we put together the standard in 2015, there was very little disagreement. We had a group of 18 people from 18 different countries participating in creating the standard. And again, guides from around the world in different settings, from Namibia to Chile to the United States. And for the most part, we're all like, yeah, that makes sense. Oh yeah, that's right. That's what we should be doing.
So what
that,
you're
that
saying,
was amazing.
Yeah, what you're saying is that you all need to go into politics, because I don't know very many arenas where people from that many countries can come together and all agree on something.
Well, again, and that is the catharsis that happens. And again, I think your podcast should be sponsored by ATTA now, because now I'm going to just start.
I'm sending them an invoice. I'm not, yes, even going to ask. I'm going to say, you know what?
Yes, but that's the amazing thing that happens at the Adventure Travel World Summit, is you realize I have more in common with my good friend from Turkey than I might with my next door neighbor, because we're in this industry together. And even though we live in different countries,
we have the passion together, yeah.
And politically, what's interesting is, because you get folks that, you know, there's a dynamic where here in the US, Canada, maybe Northern Europe as well, and some other parts of Europe, where you get this dynamic where anybody, you know, it's approachable for a middle-class person to go to college, to get a degree, to even find some funding, to start a business and do that. In most, yeah, parts of the world, that is off limits to anybody except the elite. So you get people showing up to this conference from Ecuador or from wherever, where, you know, they are the best adventure tourism company in their country. They pay good money to show up to this conference, money that, in, you know, especially as the US dollar is inflated even more, it's very difficult for them.
Yeah.
And they often come from a much higher economic class than I do. But yet we're sitting down at the table talking politics in ways that are respectful, but educational, talking about our industry in ways that we may have disagreements, but we're mostly on the same page that this travel needs to be positive for our communities, for our environment. Mm-hmm. That, like you said, that's the most amazing, because we're not homogenous by any means.
No, not by, I mean, you are in the sense of governing values, as far as, you know, wanting to make the world a better place and wanting to make the adventure travel something sustainable. But I mean, if you think, you probably have, what, I don't know, 100 different religions in that arena, right, along with 100 different political views, well, probably 1,000 different political views. And,
exactly.
And you're able to come together. That's really cool.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with that. But again, I think a lot of it has, it's identifying what are your values that you do hold sacrosanct and unifying around that. And I think the trap that we're getting into, and I think it's probably orchestrated trap, is the binary. You're either on this team or that team. You either believe in climate change or you don't believe in climate change.
Right.
You either think that, any of these issues. And the reality is, things are way more complicated. I was just discussing the issue of fires, and indeed, climate change does exacerbate makes fire season go longer. It's hotter, and so the forest dry out. It's not as cold in the winter, so bark beetles. But the reality is there's also, are we managing our forests appropriately? We haven't for the last 100 years.
Right.
Managing very differently, fire suppression combined with just devastated clear cutting. So, I mean, if we're just going to say this is climate change, I think we're missing a whole important way that we could be dealing with the issue of fire. But because we're so binary, you're either on the climate change or you're not. We're missing opportunities to collaborate with. I mean, climate change is an extreme example because it shouldn't be binary because it's the wealth of evidence is so clear. But I think there are other issues where there's much more gray area that, but we're forced to choose a side. And I think that prevents us from actually solving problems a lot of times because we're unwilling to move outside of our team.
This has been quite delightful.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you so much for coming on. How about you leave us with your favorite travel destination and then a piece of advice for travelers today?
Right. So I would say one of my favorite parts of the world is my home state of Minnesota. And what I love about, it's interesting living in a place, and you can relate to that now with your time in Vancouver, Washington. But it's interesting living in a place where you just got the beauty here just punches you in the face. It's like, how are you not going to notice Mount Rainier, or in your case, Mount Hood, just towering over everything and like defying the, like, how is that a mountain? Like, how is that possible? Right.
Right.
You go to some place like Minnesota and you go to like maybe the Boundary Waters or Lake Superior, and it's more, or the prairie, even better example would be the prairie, where you just got these grasses blowing and big,
you can
sky.
See for miles. Yeah.
Yeah. And you see a thunderstorm about to roll in. It's a much more subtle beauty. And I think it is more rewarding for those who take the time. I really, as I've traveled around the world, I've really understood and been able to respect the people that kind of instilled these values in me. And those would be very classic Minnesota type values of, you know, being open to different things, but also being slightly skeptical of something new. So I would recommend people who haven't had a chance to travel, especially I'll just say one specific place would be the Boundary Waters, either in the summer or the winter. Winter is an incredible time to be. I mean, imagine being below 0 Fahrenheit, which coincidentally can even be below 0 Celsius all the time. Very cold place, just frozen tundra, but you walk into a forest and see a chickadee. Like, how is this bird surviving? It's 34 degrees below zero, and it's just like peppy as all. So I would recommend people going to the Boundary Waters in Minnesota. It's a wonderful destination, great place to connect with nature. And I think for travelers in general, we need to acknowledge that, similar to how zoos and aquariums at one point realized that we're going to go extinct if we don't change our messaging, if we don't make what we do have to be positive for conservation and for the environment. And even with all that, there's still some degree of questioning of whether we should, for example, elephants in zoos, for example. I think the travel industry is going to be at a similar crossroads very soon, in that if we don't address the fact that flying around the globe is terrible for the environment, and that if we don't acknowledge that when done wrong, we can have devastating impacts on the environment of places we visit, on the communities. So from a traveler's perspective, just recognize that you're showing up somewhere not just to learn, but to exchange. Some of that exchange is through commerce, but some of it is also through just mutual respect. Again, I think we are, especially in adventure tourism, we're often going somewhere that quote unquote exotic or whatever, but just remember that that's people's homes. And by being respectful and sharing that respect, we have an opportunity to really change the world.
That's awesome. We're going to leave it all on that. Thank you so much for coming on, Dan.
Yeah.
And I am sure we will have you back again.
Sounds good. Great to connect with you.
Hey, Shayna here. Interviewing Dan was very informative. A few takeaways for me. Contact a local guide if you want to know if a company is genuinely sustainable. Also, like Dan said, if we're going to change the world, it's through education. Visit adventurewriters.agency to join my mailing list and get updates when a new episode airs. Until next time, bon voyage!